I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Look, I know it's only October, but the new year will be here before you know it. Our smart money experts say now's a critical time to get your financial affairs in order before ringing in 2018. Today, we'll discuss key strategies and get tax tips to keep in mind as you approach Thanksgiving, Christmas, and January 1st. But we'll also reveal year-end pitfalls to avoid, like holiday overspending. And President Trump's unified tax reform framework was released last month, and fiscal types are pondering its implications. Our financial planners will go over the potential impacts of the plan. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Last month, President Trump and congressional Republicans unveiled their tax reform package. No bill has been put forward, but the framework for a major overhaul of the tax code has been outlined. What does it mean for you? What are the key components of this plan that should affect what you owe Uncle Sam next April 15th? That, and it's not too early to begin thinking about some year-end tax planning. With us once again to walk us through all this are our smart money experts. They are Sandy Weavers, who's a CPA and a certified financial planner certificate with Petrovic Weaver Financial Services. Sandy, good to have you.
Morning, Steve.
Lucas Butchel is a principal with KHC Wealth Management. Lucas, good morning to you.
Good morning.
David Jackson is a certified financial planner, practitioner, and financial advisor for Waddell and Reed Financial Planners. And David, welcome back to you.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
Let's begin by talking about some recent developments in the world of personal finance, as we always do when you guys come on, and some current events here. The Fed is about to begin reducing its balance sheet this month. Sandy, what's that all about, and what does that mean?
That means that they are going to be buying fewer bonds out in the marketplace than they typically do. It will tighten up liquidity very, very slowly. Some of the stimulus will move out of the system. It would be, in a way, akin to a very small rise in interest rates at the short end. Hopefully, we won't notice it.
Why does the Fed have to buy bonds?
They did a lot of that right after 2008 because they were trying to put liquidity into the system. They were trying to add stimulus to get everything back on its feet.
Add money into the system,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Right, and to keep things going at that hard time. Okay. How much are we talking? What kind of amount do they owe, Lucas, as you look back on it?
Yep, so their total balance sheet right now is $4.5 trillion with a T. And they're going to begin to very slowly start rolling off some of these bonds that mature, which will shrink their balance sheet. They're going to start with $10 billion in October, so this month, and then the plan is to slowly increase that to $50 billion per month next year.
And David, this could result in what? Some as Sandy is saying, higher interest rates long term?
That's kind of the expectation, and that's kind of the desire as well. You know, interest rates have been at an all-time low for a significant period of time. So the Fed is trying to get back to a sense of normalcy and get these rates back into a normal range.
So the thinking is it's been normal, low for a long time. It seems normal, but the thinking is they're too low.
Yeah, they're too low. And as inflation goes up, we expect interest rates will go up, both short-term and long-term, which is going to affect people who are going out buying cars, buying mortgages. But it also affect people who have savings in the bank, too. They'll be getting a little bit higher interest rate there as well.
Let's turn to the other big financial breach, security breach we saw just in recent weeks here. Sandy, fill us in there.
Oh, Equifax.
Equifax.
Yes, one of the three major credit bureaus. And they have a lot of data on all of us here in this room. About $145 million or million Americans, the data for those folks was hacked. So, you know, it's something we really need to be concerned about and to take some action on.
What should people be thinking about doing, Lucas, if given that probably at least two of us in this room are probably affected?
Yep. So the first thing you should do is definitely consider signing up for the credit monitoring. Equifax is offering that for free to all Americans. And the other thing that they should strongly consider is freezing their credit. That's where you kind of lock down your credit records at the credit bureaus, and that doesn't allow new credit to be opened on your behalf. So it might be an inconvenience for you, but it definitely cuts the criminals off at the pass.
So if you don't do that, what might happen?
Someone can open an account in your name, so go take debt out on your credit record, and you're going to find out about it after the fact when the debt collection letters start to show up, or you go to apply for a loan on for your purposes, and you find out your credit score has been dramatically lowered because you've got unpaid bills out there that you never knew existed.
Am I on the hook if someone borrows money in my name?
Generally not. However, the hassle of cleaning it up, it takes a lot of time, can't take some money, and whatever debt you were planning to take on your own to buy a car, buy a home, that purchase most likely gets delayed as you try to get through the process of cleaning up the credit.
So let's walk through again a couple of the steps you're recommending here. Sign up for credit monitoring. Equifax is offering that for free. What is that exactly?
That's a service. Equifax isn't the only one that does it. There's a variety out there that do it. But basically what they do is any activity that hits your credit report, so somebody's applying for loans on your behalf.
But when I hear about that, somehow, when I get a letter in the mail saying, you come down to the office and sign this form because you want to borrow some money?
No, you're not going to find out about it because they're not going to use your active address. So they're not going to send you a letter because the address that the criminal uses is most likely going to be fictitious. And so you're not going to find out about it most likely until you access your credit in some way.
Let me give you an example, because this kind of happened to me just recently in the past month.
It happened to a financial planner?
Yeah. So
it can't be true.
I get these three letters on the same day, and they're each one of the letters pretty innocuous, where if it hadn't been three of them, I probably would have just ignored them, thinking it was junk mail. But I open the letters up, and all three are saying that I've changed my address for my credit card or whatever, and so I call up and it's like, no, I haven't changed my address. What's up? And they said, well, somebody apparently has hacked your email and gone in and tried to attempt to change your address. So then they could have gone in and made loans in my name, taken out loans in my name, and the statements would have been gone to this fictitious address somewhere out in California, and I wouldn't have known about it until way later, and I'd have had all kind of headaches trying to unwind it. So I did have to get this sign up for the credit monitoring, lock down my credit, because I don't know who has my information now. I don't know if this was specifically related to Equifax or not. I just know it happened right around the same time that the information came out about Equifax.
What a wonderful world we live in. And Lucas, when you say consider freezing your credit, what do you do? If someone hears that, what does that mean? Who do I call?
Yep. So what that does is that really locks down your credit information at the major credit bureaus. So you have to approach each of the three major credit bureaus. Those are TransUnion, Equifax, and Experian. You can do it online or over the phone. It takes about 10 minutes per credit agency. There is a small nominal fee, depending on the state you live in, you know, $5 to $10 to do so. But really what it does is it does not allow your credit information to be used for new loans. So then if you are ever going to apply for debt yourself, you would have to contact the agency, unfreeze your credit, do your business, and then refreeze it.
You know, no one's going to do this, though. I mean, good advice, I hear you, but, you know, 1% of Americans are going to take your advice and do it, which leaves us where?
Well, I do think I'm going to do it. I have, of course, already signed up for the free ID protection service, but I don't plan to open a new credit card. I do check my annual credit report that everybody gets for free. I do check that. But I'm not planning on buying anything that's going to require debt. So anybody that, you know, would be checking my credit is probably something I would really want to know about first. So I have thought that I probably will be freezing my account. So unless you have a big purchase coming up that you know you're going to use debt for, you know, paying the $15 we would pay in our two states to do it probably is a smart idea.
To freeze your credit, you're saying.
Yeah,
yeah. Because you can always go back and unfreeze it.
Yeah.
But it's just, you know... And I definitely did because, you know, I've got...
But who's going to, in October 2017, I froze my credit. So 3 years from now, I'm going to buy a car. I got to go unfreeze my credit. I mean, what? I mean, that's just nuts. Yeah. But that's the world. You're looking at me like, that's the way you got. That's the world.
That's a lot less red tape than cleaning up I'd eat that.
Big mess, yeah.
Okay. All right. So that's what all that is. Okay. Let's move on to our major topic here, which is breaking down the Trump tax plan proposal. You know, the White House and congressional Republicans just laid this thing out at the end of September. Just an overall question here, David. You know, is the goal here on behalf of Republicans to be able to do your taxes on a postcard, or is the goal to cut taxes? Where are we going here?
I love the question, because that is the question.
That is the question.
And so, and we have a difference of opinion on this panel. So I don't think the chances of this going through, to me, are very, very slim, because there are some Republicans who are what you call deficit hawks. It's like, as long as this does not add anything to the deficit, I'm good with it. And this is going to add
Republicans
something.
Haven't passed anything major. They're desperate to pass something.
Right, that's true.
Enormous pressure to get something across the finish line.
That is true. But you know, guys, you know politics a whole lot better than I do. And there are people like Little Corker or somebody like that who's like, well, you're going to insult me and then you expect me to sign off on a bill that I disagree with in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
So I think the chances of this going through are kind of slim myself. Some others on the panel will totally disagree with me, and we'll just see what happens.
Lucas, what do you think the objective is here?
I think the objective is to cut taxes. I think the file your taxes on a postcard is a sales pitch to get people in on board with it. I think there's a variety of things in here that are designed to cut taxes, and quite frankly, some of it will be stimulative to the economy, which, you know, we can talk about whether that's a good thing or not, or how they're going about it is a good thing. But I don't think there's any question that this is a tax cut plan. I mean, this is a Republican administration and Congress. And I think if one thing Republicans can agree on is they want to cut taxes. And that's why I think there's a decent chance something gets done. Probably not to the degree of the entire framework. I think that's probably unreasonable. But I think some program will get put into place either this year or next year.
Why do we need a tax cut right now, Sandy? Maybe you don't think we do, but what's the point? The economy seems to be going along pretty well. The deficit's pretty high, at least based on what you hear some lawmakers say. So why would we cut taxes right now?
Especially on the corporation side, you can argue that the United States has a higher corporate tax rate than other countries do. And you've
not
seen,
all countries, I'm told, but some countries,
yes,
right?
Yes. And so you've seen some companies moving their, you know, headquarters and offices overseas so that they can play with those countries' foreign tax rates instead. And then, you know, there's been some backlash against that. So, you know, if anything gets passed, the piece that's most likely to be passed will be on that corporate tax rate table.
Mm-hmm. Lucas, do we need a tax cut?
I think there is some opportunity for a tax cut to be beneficial both for corporations and for individuals.
Always beneficial, right? But is it needed?
I think so. I think so at some level. I think the need for some additional stimulus to incent some economic growth, I think, is true. It is needed.
Because we're not growing at as fast a rate as a lot of people think we should be growing right now.
Absolutely. And by historical standards, this has been a very anemic recovery, still growing at less than 3% and less than 2.5% most likely this year. So I think additional growth is something that should help push wages up. There's a lot of conversation about how wage growth has been very stagnant over the last decade. I think if you can get another leg up in economic growth, that changes. And so I think there is a benefit, but you got to do it the right way.
David, how do you vote on this? Break the impasse here.
Well, so here, the big picture is when you run the numbers from what I've been hearing, most of the tax breaks are going to go to the wealthy. And the stimulus that Lucas is talking about is if you give middle class and poor people a tax break and they have more money in their pocket and they spend. So
they spend it right away.
Yeah,
to
stimulate
the
economy.
Yeah.
So if you're a multimillionaire, getting a tax break, it's not going to cause you to spend more money. You know, you've already got
everything.
Yeah. But the average person, you know, you give them a tax break and you give them $200 more a month in their pockets, they're going to spend it. That's going to stimulate the economy. And I don't think that's what this bill does. I think it's really most of the benefits are geared towards that 1%. And the 1% is not going to take that money and spend it. So the corporate side, it may make a difference, especially where they're talking about corporations bringing money back into the United States that they've been hiding. But really the big stimulus to the economy is ordinary people spending money, and I don't see where this bill does that.
And given all the outrage in the country about the rich getting richer, you wonder then if that's true, what you just said, why the tax package would be aimed at the wealthy more than just the average person out
but
there.
But I know you pay attention to politics, and when it's being talked about, they're not talking about the 1%. They're talking about this is the greatest thing ever for the middle class.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying the numbers do not bear that out. But if it was a big tax break for the middle class, I would think, you know, everybody would get behind it because that would have a stimulative effect.
If our listeners have thoughts on what they think about this initial foray into tax reform that the Trump administration is undertaking here, we'd be interested in getting your thoughts. 816-235-2888 is our number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Well, let's, again, break this thing down a little further here, Sandy. Individuals, the individual tax bracket changes would be what here?
We would move from 7 brackets down to 3. And that 25% bracket, which is pretty wide already, that would widen even more. The highest bracket of 39.6, that would go down to, initially they came in at 33, and now that's they've revised that, saying that would drop to 35. But that's where David's right, that you know the upper income are going to benefit more from the tax bracket squeeze.
Okay. And the increase of the child tax credit would also go up, and the child care tax credit. Lucas, explain this one because this is a big deal for a lot of people.
Yep. So this is some of the stuff that probably would hit some of the middle or upper middle folks, and that's an increase in the child tax credit and the child care tax credit. So those are two different credits, both going to families that are raising kids, either just a standard credit for having a child. Or if you're paying for child care, a credit to help offset some of those costs.
These ideas have been kicked around for a long time now, that a need to increase both those, right?
Indeed. And this the framework they laid out talks about increasing both of those. They haven't put any specifics in terms of numbers on those yet. But I think that's a piece of this that I think would be beneficial and has been called for on both sides of the aisle.
To be clear, a lot of specifics haven't been ironed out here and haven't been released. These are broad parameters we're talking about here today.
Exactly. It's important to know that this is a framework and not a bill. So right now, you know, the lawmakers are talking about this. Their staffs are working on actual legislation. And so, you know, there's been some independent analyses that have tried to look at all this and the impact. And I think a lot of that uses a lot of assumptions. And so once we get our an actual bill that we can sink our teeth into and look at the numbers, I think then more of the clarity around numbers and the impact and on who becomes more clear.
Well, this is going to be a shock to you. People have opinions about this new tax package. The calls are coming in at 816-235-2888. Let's go to Bill from Spring Hill. Bill, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. I would like to ask the panelists why they think something that was tried and failed in Kansas is going to work nationwide. Kansas is still trying to dig out from underneath the deficits that were created, and we still can't get the school funding right. What's going on? Why should we justify going to nationwide on this type of bill?
Bill is not the first person to raise this question. Sandy, he's talking about there's pass-through tax breaks here for LLCs that got the big break in Kansas would get a big break under this plan. What's going on?
That's true. Arthur Laffer's curve, you know, didn't quite come true when Kansas tried it. And again, that pass-through entities under the new tax proposal would be taxed at 25% instead of on the individual, you know, up to 39.6.
Mm-hmm.
So that would cap that. As far as why that might work this time, your guess is as good as mine. but the point is to stimulate business. If you stimulate business, you stimulate jobs, and that's what it's supposed to do, is get jobs and get better-paying jobs into the hands of the middle class so that we can rebuild that segment.
But according to a lot of metrics, though, the big LLC tax break in Kansas didn't do that.
You're right.
Okay. Lucas?
Yeah, I think a couple of differences, though, that I think are worthwhile to point out, and not that I'm advocating for the pass-through reduction. Number one, it's not going to zero, right, as it did in Kansas. The second is the federal government has the ability to borrow money to help fund this. Kansas does not, so they, you know, effectively had to slash spending because the revenue didn't come in.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think there's some significant differences between what happened in Kansas and what's being proposed here. However, I think the debate is still very much worthwhile. Is this what we want to do? I think the part of the element here is if you're reforming corporate tax reform for certain types of corporations, the pass-through entities are just a different structure of a corporation. And so I think the corporate tax reform is they're trying to apply that to both sides of the ledger here.
Yeah, so let me throw something in on this. So this whole idea with the LLCs that when Kansas tried it, the whole idea was, well, let's stimulate small businesses.
Right.
Well, the small businesses that were taking advantage of it were not the type of businesses that were going to go out and hire people. They were just going to pocket a tax cut. And so we could take this to the national level. That's exactly the same thing's going to happen. You're going to have business people that are going to restructure their business
mm-hmm.
to get a tax cut. It doesn't mean they're going to hire more people because, again, companies hire more people when they have more demand. And they have more demand when the middle class is spending more money. This is not designed to do that. So this is just another way. Oh, I'm not supposed to get political. I apologize. This is, does not work.
Okay, so big questions here. Yeah, Lucas?
You may not see the restructuring element because, again, the corporate tax rate on C corporations, at least under the framework, would be going down from 35 down to 20.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're paying 20 on the corporate side, would you restructure to take an increase up to 25%? Probably not.
Yeah. Back to some calls here. Tim from Lenexa. Tim, you're on Up to Date.
Thank you, Steve. Really enjoy the show.
Good. Thanks.
My question is about the corporate tax. And previous corporate taxes really doesn't help the benefit of the middle class because companies tend to just purchase back their own shares of stock, which helps the executives and so forth, you know, but as far as actually helping the middle class, it doesn't because the buyback shares really don't do anything except for the real affluent who has the shares in the company.
So you have questions about how much the middle class would benefit here too, Tim?
Correct. Yeah. I think the presumption is that they'll hire a significant amount of people, but in past corporate tax reductions, the companies just buy back more shares of their own stock.
All right. Appreciate the phone call. Thanks, Tim. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation about the tax reform package that's come out of Washington in recent days. We'll continue our talk about how individuals will be affected. We'll talk about businesses as well, and also some thoughts on year-end tax planning. It's not too soon to start thinking about all of that. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. On Friday's show, we found out how forensic science is helping to identify deceased undocumented migrants at the border with Mexico. We also heard how mass shootings affect the passage of new gun laws. You can find those conversations at kcur.org and on the NPR One app. Tomorrow, we'll meet economist Robert Shiller, who was awarded the Nobel Prize back in 2013 for his research on market volatility. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, this hour, we're visiting with our smart money experts, and they are smart. Sandy Weaver with Petrovic Weaver Financial Services, Lucas Butchell, a principal with KHC Wealth Management, David Jackson's with Waddell and Reed Financial Advisors. We're looking for your thoughts on President Trump's the bare outlines of a tax reform package he's laid on the table. What do you think? 816-235-2888 is our number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Gang, before the break, we were talking about the impact of this plan on individuals. We got partway through that. Let's continue on here. Sandy, the plan would also eliminate most itemized deductions, such as?
It would eliminate your deduction for state and local taxes.
Wow.
That's going to hit high tax states. If you're paying a California resident, you lose that deduction. It will eliminate property taxes. So if you have two houses or an expensive house that hits high income, it's going to eliminate medical costs. And I review the tax returns of all the clients, you know, at Petrovic Weaver. And when you see those deductions, those are usually older folks who get over that 7.5%, 10% hurdle, Or sometimes you'll see somebody in their 50s who's just had a, you know, hellacious year medically, but that's going to hurt those folks. And then investment expenses, anything else in that miscellaneous itemized deduction box. So that means job hunt expenses. If you're paying your people like us sitting here today, your financial advisor, that gets hit in there.
Right.
So this, what they're doing in to compensate for all the loss of these deductions is almost doubling the standard deduction.
So, but to be clear, the deductions for mortgage interest and charitable deductions remain here, right? If you take away the property tax deduction right now, wouldn't that put a huge crimp in folks who like buy an extra house as a rental house, David, and as an investment, and they can write off the taxes and maybe make a profit that way?
Yes, it would. But the bigger issue, no, it wouldn't.
No.
The bigger issue I wanted to get to, though, is the state and local tax issue. If you're not going to be able to deduct that, that's a little bit of a payback, because most of the states that have high state income taxes are Democratic states. So it's like he's punishing those states like California, New York, Maryland by saying you can't get that deduction anymore. And, you know, states like Texas that don't have state income taxes, like, okay, no big deal.
But rental home owners would not be affected here?
Rental homeowners would be able to deduct it as that's going to be part of their business. So that's going to be the rental home element comes through as business income. So that the business income will be netted off business expenses, which is what those property taxes would be. Somebody that it would hit would be somebody that has a second home that they just use for their pleasure, a condo in Florida, lake home, that kind of thing. That's the type of person that's going to get hit with not being able to deduct either their primary or secondary property taxes.
Darn it, I got four homes I got to worry about. You know, what am I going to do,
David? You're
going to
lose
that. I'm in bad shape. How about eliminating the head of household filing status? What does that mean?
That hurts single parents.
Explain that to me.
Well, you get if you have children and you have a dependent, they're living in the home with you, you get a special tax rate table. It is not as good as married joint. It's not as bad as single. So you get, you know, you get sort of a better table in there, you know, if you have a child living at home with you.
Okay.
Dependent.
Elimination of the alternative minimum tax. David?
Well, so that's a tax that's kind of built in for people who have a lot of deductions. They say, you know, and it was designed for wealthy people to say, if you got all these deductions,
you still got to pay something.
Yeah, we're going to make sure you pay something. So they're trying to get rid of that. And the significant thing about that is that they failed to index that to keep up with the cost of living. So the original idea was to capture wealthy people, and now it's capturing a lot of upper middle class and middle class folks.
Okay, and there's also the elimination of the estate tax, right?
That's right. And that's not going to hurt that many people numbers-wise. Right now, I think it's like 5.5% or something, that you can leave. And then there's the portability provision. So if you're, you know, a couple and you're the second one to die, you can leave $10 million now and not have estate taxes. So only your upper income is going to get hit. Well, if they eliminate it, they will benefit from that,
Which made the conversation really interesting, that this is not going to help rich people, because that's only going to help wealthy people.
Yes, you're right.
Tom called to ask what happens to step up in basis regarding the inheritance tax with the proposed tax plan. What does that mean?
So the way it works right now is when you pass away and you have assets that have appreciated, that gets a step up in basis. So the basis is reset as of the date of death. And so let's say you had a rental home that had a very low basis, or let's say you had a shares of stock that had really appreciated. When you pass away, that basis gets reset to a higher level. So that hasn't been addressed in the framework. So there's really been no clarity given in terms of how that issue would be handled. It's a valid one, though. So a lot of times in the past, with proposals to get rid of the estate tax, they've also proposed getting rid of that step-up in basis, which would lead to more capital gains taxes when those assets are ultimately sold.
Let's go to Kim from Mission Hills. Kim, you're on Up to Date, Kim.
Good morning.
Good morning.
As I read it, this tax proposal would disproportionately benefit the wealthiest Americans. And It's my understanding, I'm not an economist or a politician, but it's my understanding that the wealth gap and the increasing gap between wealthy and poor and concentration of wealth is not only unfair, but it actually will destabilize our country and the very fabric of what we all think of as America. So my question is, given the fact that the wealth gap is bad, but given the fact also that wealth and money drives politicians. It supports their candidacies. It really affects politics in America. So is it impossible to reclaim a more balanced society?
Okay, in 20 words or less, we'll try to get answers for you here, Kim. Who wants to tackle the wealth gap? Yeah, Lucas.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question that the framework as laid out would substantially benefit the wealthy. And so I think that's a real question. I think that's a real concern. Is this would likely expand the wealth gap? And from a societal standpoint, I think that's something that is concerning. I don't know that it crushes the American society, but I think it does create additional division. And segregation of the wealthy, and I don't know that is a good thing long term.
This destabilization that Kim talks about and the threat to our society, any thoughts there, David?
I mean, it's real. You know, anytime you've had a revolution in a country, it's usually been because those that had were pushing so much pressure on those who didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And so if it keeps getting worse, yeah, there's definitely some consideration to that. And that's why when you hear them promoting this tax bill, they keep talking about the fact that it's for middle class people. It's like, whether it is or not, if I can sell it as a middle tax cut and people fall for it, then, you know, hey, everybody's happy. Well,
right.
Maybe not.
Let's go to Mike from Waldo, who has a question about what is considered to be middle class. Mike, good morning.
Yes, Steve. On so many programs, I hear them throwing around the term middle class. Well, Donald Trump, maybe middle class is between $3 and $4 million. But my question is, when in your minds, because your minds are as good as anybody else, in your minds, what is middle class in dollars?
That's a great question. I'm glad you asked it, Mike. Yeah, Sandy.
That was actually addressed on Bloomberg Radio, Business Radio, TV this morning, and it varies by state. It's $120,000, I want to say, over in California, $112,000 over in New York, and yet $52,000, I think, in Mississippi.
You mean that's the minimum to be?
The middle class is defined by some average earnings.
Is in that range of $52,000 in Mississippi and $120,000?
Yes.
Do we know what it is in Missouri and Kansas?
They didn't say.
Yeah. Okay.
It seemed like I've heard around 75 for a family of four, 75,000.
Again,
that's average.
Is that the upper limit of what middle class?
No, that'd be middle.
In the middle of it.
Yeah, so I think the middle class range goes up to about 150,000 a year of income.
Okay.
And that seems about right. I think that it's worth noting that there is no official definition of middle class, right? It's a squishy definition, but I think most people would assume that between 50 and 150,000 a year of family income would be reasonable.
So you sort of know it when you're living it.
Exactly,
I think.
Right.
So yeah, I get that. Okay, let's move on to how this plan would impact businesses. Who wants to tackle that? Because the top corporate tax rates would drop here. Lucas, run with that.
Yep. So that's a big one. You know, everybody talks about the U.S. has a high corporate tax rate. You know, and that is true. We have one at 35%, although most corporations don't pay an average rate of 35%, but they're talking about reducing that to 20%. So that'd be a significant reduction in the top corporate tax rate in the U.S. for U.S. corporations.
And you guys are saying that's a little bit more justifiable than the individual cuts? Sandy, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, yes, it would be. It would put us on more of a level playing field
with
if we got our
countries.
Corporate. Yes. And then the argument is that we would have more corporate activity, more jobs generated.
But then the numbers that I've seen shows the effective tax rate that corporations pay in this country is about in the middle of the road for all other industrialized countries. So I don't know if, you know, even though the high number is 35%, I don't know if anybody's paying anywhere close to that.
I think we're still above average, but not monstrously so, yeah. Significantly so, yeah.
The net interest deductions for businesses would be limited as well. Lucas?
Yeah, so that's a deduction. So there's really two giveaways that a lot of people view as loopholes that are getting closed here. One is the net interest deduction. That benefits corporations that do the inversions that are really popular, so where they effectively take their headquarters overseas and do some complex tax planning to get some benefits. And then the other is
and that would be limited. Then that would be for the middle income person. That would be seen as a good thing, I guess. Right?
Exactly. Right. Mm-hmm. And Trump has really banged the drum in terms of corporations, taking advantage and exporting jobs and going overseas. This is really a shot at that. Is really trying to limit the benefit of that activity.
Why has it taken us so long to address that concern? Because so many people don't like that idea.
Yeah, it's a great question. I have no idea. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And what it really does is allows a lot of complex tax planning to really game the system.
Okay. How about elimination of the carried interest exemption for hedge funds? God, we're getting in the weeds here. What does that mean? Yeah,
really, this is the number one tax loophole that gets talked about with tax reform. And that's a benefit that converts ordinary income, so income that you'd normally pay a high tax rate on, into capital gain income, which means lower taxes. And it really benefits hedge funds. And everybody's talked about that for a long time. This provision would get eliminated with this update.
Okay, so just to be clear here, most taxpayers would still benefit from this plan. Sandy, do I have that right? It just depends by how much,
yes,
depending on what bracket of income you're in.
So low, middle, and upper all benefit, but who benefits more is the upper end.
Okay, and some of the argument here is that perhaps the middle and lower incomes ought to be considered a little more deeply here. What else can we say about this plan that we know at this point, David?
Well, so the big issue is that there are a lot of politicians out there who feel if this is going to add anything to the deficit, then it's a no-go. And so they've been using some fancy numbers that say, well, if we lower taxes, the economy is going to just boom. I kind of disagree because, as we saw in the state of Kansas, just lowering taxes does not make the economy boom. But if they're able to, justify that, then they can say that it's revenue neutral.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's not revenue neutral, I don't think the chances of it getting passed are very strong at all.
Let's go back to some phone calls here. And Mick from Prairie Village. Mick, you're on Up to Date with our Smart Money team. We're talking about the Trump tax plan. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I have a question about the tax rates. And I hear a lot of discussion about what's fair and what's not fair. But just for an example, the top 1%, according to the Tax Foundation, earned 20.6% of the income, but they pay 40% of taxes. I don't have the top 10%, but those are the wealthy people. And I just wonder what your panel might think, what a fair tax rate might be, number one. But number two, what's unfair with giving the wealthy more of the tax breaks, given that they pay a disproportionate share of the taxes?
That's a little bit like asking for an opinion, not so much advice. But anyone want to address that? Or, yeah.
I think it's all about whose ox is being gored, right? So a lot of times it depends on the position you're coming from as to what's fair or not. I think the caller earlier that talked about, the wealth gap in the country, I think that's probably the conversation we should have, and how important is that and what do we want for society. But I think most people that, pay a lot of tax would say, look, this is something that would benefit me, and that's probably fair. So mm-hmm. Fairness is in the eye of the beholder.
And let me add one more point, though. A poor person, if you just took their income and said, how much of your total income are you paying for all the different types of taxes, including sales taxes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, the poor person is paying a larger percentage of their overall income to some type of taxes than the rich person.
Mm-hmm.
So even though this rich person is saying, well, my money is funding the federal government and my federal income taxes, what is fair? How do you, if you eliminate all those other taxes and just, you know what I'm saying?
I just wonder, how could you possibly ever address that, though? Just by the laws of mathematics, folks who don't make as much money are going to, their percentage of their income going towards taxes is just going to be higher, right?
That's the way it is now. The people with low income, more of their income total is going
right
towards taxes, even though it may not be going towards federal income taxes.
Mm-hmm.
So to say, okay, let's make it more fair and so that the wealthy don't pay as much of their income taxes. I mean, of their income to federal income taxes, may now put even more burden on the poor person who's already paying more of their income towards taxes in general.
Just a final point about all this. I wanted to just to clarify. The president has claimed that this plan will be revenue neutral. Is it?
Well, there's no specifics in terms of numbers, so it's hard to say. But one of the things that they're depending on is
growth
in
the out years, right? In the years to come, the economy will expand because of these tax cuts and will then, quote, pay for it, right?
Exactly. And that's really hard to quantify. And so there's going to be a lot of assumptions made. And of course, you know, the president's going to want that assumption to be as big as possible. And I think folks that are campaigning against the bill will want it to be as small as possible. So I think there's probably some benefit that will be gained, but probably not as much as the administration advocates for.
Well, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking today with our smart money experts about the Trump tax plan. We're going to switch to, topics here in the minutes that we have remaining to talk about smart year-end planning tips to improve your finances. And I guess the lesson here, the takeaway is going to be it's not too early to start talking about this. In fact, it's exactly the right time. One point here, healthcare, evaluating your insurance options. A lot of people are doing that right now, including yours truly. Sandy, what would you say about that?
I think you should find out what your insurance is going to be. Right about now is about when you can do that, too. Find out what the increase is going to be next year and then evaluate your options. I think it's an excellent time to educate yourself on the jargon of that industry. You should know by now or learn what a copay means to you. Do you go to the doctor often or not very often? Learn what a deductible means to you. Mm-hmm. And getting some good advice will help you pick a good plan, whether you get it through your employer or whether you get it on your own.
So your point is to say you don't understand this stuff, maybe it doesn't cut it.
That yeah.
you owe it to yourself to figure this stuff out. And,
right.
you know, PPOs and HMO, it's confusing.
I struggle with it.
Yeah.
It is.
Too confusing, maybe.
But it's the lay of the land, and it matters to you more and more. Employers are shoving the cost of these over onto individuals. And so, you know, it's time to dig into that and find out how your specific health expenditure experience maps into your choices
right.
so that you can make a good choice for yourself and your family.
Lucas?
Inertia is a powerful thing with people just kind of continuing the status quo. There's been so many changes in this space and the cost dynamics have really changed. If you haven't evaluated it, you really owe it to yourself to look at it, consider your options, and like Sandy said, kind of look at what's best for your family.
Okay. Something else to think about, holiday spending. David, you want to talk about...
Man, it'll be here before we know it, too.
You're going to be a Scrooge here, right, and tell me I can't spend as much as I want to spend.
Well, you know, there's a recent survey that came out that said Americans are expected to increase their holiday spending by over
6%. That's a big number,
isn't it? It actually is, you know.
Yeah.
And so it tells you that people are feeling a whole lot more confident about their finances and feeling comfortable about, you know, making those kind of expenditures. So our advice to people is just go into the holidays with a plan. You know, set yourself with expectations how much you're going to spend and then break it down to, okay, I've got $1,000 to spend. You know, this is how it's going to be broken down. You know, your wife comes first, of course. You know, you got to spend most of the money on her.
Yeah.
And then the kids and then, you know, but
right.
Go into it with a plan because people with income from 100 to 150,000 are expected to increase their spending by 15%. So people are feeling pretty
15%.
Optimistic. 15%.
So. But the poll numbers don't suggest that people are that bullish on the economy. I'm struck by the fact that people are really willing to open up their wallets and start spending for the holidays.
Well, you know, there is that so-called wealth effect. When the stock market is going up, people feel a lot better about their finances. When home prices are going up, people are feeling more comfortable about their personal finances and feel a little bit more comfortable about spending money.
Okay. People do tend to spend too much during the holiday season, Sandy, and then they're paying for it in the months to come. What do you make of that practice?
If you take David up on his, you know, have a plan before you just walk into Christmas and the holidays, some of the things is figure out who you're going to give gifts to and how much and some ideas and where you're going to buy those gifts. You can use some apps that make it easy. One of the apps is Christmas Gifts and Budgets.
What does that do?
It will help you put in your plan. You can lay out your plan right there on your phone and say, I'm going to give to Uncle Harry, and I'm going to give to my three children, going to give to my husband. and these are the items I'm thinking about. Here's how much I've budgeted for that person, and you know where I can get this gift the cheapest. You can do those kind of things there.
Do people budget for Christmas and the holidays?
You should.
They should.
Yeah, yeah. Our producer Danny Alexander is giving me a big nod. Yeah. It seems like you just, and you know, oh, we're running short on this sum. We got to go out and get something else for them.
Yeah.
And that's what happens here. Okay. Holiday travel, Lucas?
Yeah, I think this is one that people oftentimes delay and then they pay more for. So just be thoughtful about your holiday travel in terms of when you're buying your tickets. Sooner the better. But then also, if you've got some flexibility in your schedule, really try to plan it so you can travel off times and not pay kind of full premium price for travel at the holidays.
Couple things related to travel. You can try traveling on the exact holiday itself, and the tickets are cheaper
on
those days.
It is
yes.
cheaper on that day.
Sometimes an empty plane or sort of empty plane, which can be nice. There's also a couple of websites that will give you some insight into getting cheaper travel expenses. SmarterTravel.com and CheaperAir.com are good.
Okay. How about increasing or maximizing retirement plan and health savings account contributions? What might people think about doing there, David?
Yeah, as we get towards the end of the year, especially self-employed people, you know, if you can afford to put more money into your retirement plan, that comes right off the top of your income. It reduces your taxable income. So you want to get that in. Even in your 401k, you know, you may decide you have a bonus coming, you know, and up your contributions for the end of the year so that more of that bonus goes into the retirement plan as well. And if you can do deductible IRAs, take advantage of that.
Now, this concept you just threw out of a bonus. Now
you've heard of those before.
Talk to me about bonuses. What is that you're talking
back
about?
Back in the good old days?
I don't know bonuses in my world. My bonus is a job, right?
You know, yeah, be happy you're here.
If you get a bonus out there, to heck with you. I don't want to talk to you. But be intentional with your bonus is your point, Sandy.
Yeah, we have a client in Colorado who does a terrific job with this. You know, obviously they've paid down debt. They have an emergency fund by now. They are saving for the boys' college. And they also then they max out the rest of the 401k. And then we do IRA contributions. We do that religiously every year. He does get a great bonus. Not everybody does.
Any final thoughts here, Lucas, as you look at all this?
I think the key thing, you hit it, is being intentional, right? So don't just react to things that are happening. So be thoughtful about how you're going to use that bonus. Be thoughtful about how you plan to spend in the holidays, and that'll really set you up to not be, you know, with that big debt overhang when you get to January.
Okay. Well, that's a very good advice, and I wonder how many people actually follow it, but that's a whole different topic, I guess. I want to thank our Smart Money team for coming in once again and helping us through with all this stuff. Sandy Weaver with Petrovic Weaver Financial Services, Lucas Butchell, a principal with KHC Wealth Management, David Jackson with Waddell & Reed Financial Advisors. Thank you all very much for a good conversation.
Great. Thank you.
Appreciate it. You can download our podcast and listen to previous programs. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. You can find us on Twitter. We're at kcurup-to-date. You can follow me at the same place, at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. On tomorrow's show, we meet Nobel Prize-winning economist Dr. Robert Shiller. The big question is, what am I going to ask him? A Nobel Prize. Is that intimidating or not? No, I won't be intimidated by Robert Shiller tomorrow. Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Justin Garnett produced this show. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.